From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Benghazi was back yesterday in a high-profile hearing on Capitol Hill. Three State Department officials, whistleblowers, said the House committee chairman, charging senior officials with not stepping up to responsibility, with withholding embarrassing facts, with telling the wrong story. Democrats cried politics, Republicans say cover-up, Americans weighing it all. This hour on Point, back to Benghazi. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Did you listen yesterday? Did you hear cover-up, conspiracy, incompetence, politics? What matters now out of Benghazi? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first today from Washington is Ernesto Londoño, national reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering the Benghazi consulate attack since the beginning, covered the hearings yesterday. Ernesto, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you and Karen DeYoung say what you heard, what they gave was accusations of senior government officials withholding embarrassing facts and failing to take enough responsibility for security lapses. How did that emerge, Ernesto?
Well, the Republicans on the House who have been spearheading this inquiry have maintained for a long time that Benghazi is not a closed chapter, that the White House and the State Department haven't really provided the full account, all the relevant facts. And over the past few weeks, they've been working with these rank-and-file State Department officials, trying to get them to come forward and tell their side of the story. And they succeeded in doing that yesterday. And what we heard was a riveting account. I think what was most startling was it marked the first time that we really got a firsthand look from somebody who was at the scene last night trying to make these judgment calls under really, really trying and scary circumstances. So I think the most interesting testimony was that of the deputy chief of mission, a veteran 22-year career State Department diplomat, who we learned yesterday shortly after the attack got sent back home and essentially, according to his account, got demoted.
This is Gregory Hicks, who was number two to the ambassador who died in Benghazi. I mean, I was struck, Ernesto, at all the talk about while they were getting word of what was going on in Benghazi and feverishly trying to do something about it, they were really worried that they might themselves be attacked in Tripoli, the capital of Libya. They were smashing hard drives with an axe there and preparing to get out.
That's right. I think that was a really fascinating piece of the narrative that that we hadn't heard. And it's very surprising that after all these months, we had no idea that officials on the ground in Tripoli had reason to believe that they themselves were going to come under attack. So the picture they paint is that that night they were in the villa compound where they reside. When they start getting these accounts from Benghazi that things there have gone terribly wrong. Now, as they're trying to sort of organize a response and marshal resources both from the Libyan government and from Washington, they themselves become very worried that an attack on them could be imminent, and they start planning to evacuate from that compound into a safer annex. And in order to do that, they need to destroy some of the sensitive material on site because it was going to remain unguarded. And they need to start thinking very carefully about how they're going to defend themselves with very few resources, with very few sort of armed bodyguards, if indeed their own facility in the capital got mobbed.
And here was Gregory Hicks yesterday describing in very emotional terms how word was coming in, how he was desperately trying to do something about it, how difficult that was to arrange. In fact, many of his efforts were stymied, frustrated. Maybe there just weren't the people. Maybe the response wasn't quick enough or enough. Here's a bit where he's talking with Trey Gowdy, Republican of South Carolina, pressed him to characterize the nature of the attack. And Hicks is talking here about Ambassador Stevens, who would later die, calling him from Benghazi to Tripoli as the attack unfolded.
He said, "Greg, we're under attack."
Would a highly decorated career diplomat have told you or Washington had there been a demonstration outside his facility that day?
Yes, sir, he would have.
Did he mention one word about a protest or a demonstration?
No, sir, he did not.
Of course, what goes unsaid in that clip, Ernesto, is that that's about all he said. The ambassador just had a few seconds on the phone, as I read your story here, before it went dead.
That's right. We have very little insight from the folks who were with him in Benghazi and the small unsecured villa where the U.S. maintained a diplomatic mission there, about what happened, about what they saw, about how much time they had to react. I think that still is an enigma and may remain so forever.
Describe for us, Ernesto, from what you heard yesterday. And again, this is the number two, the deputy chief of mission in Tripoli, the capital, as Benghazi was going up in flames. Describe his efforts to corral help to get to Benghazi. What did he try? What happened?
Well, the first thing they do is they get on the phone with the Libyan government. And you have to remember, this is a very, very new government that essentially was built from the ashes and had very little command and control, didn't have sort of a formal army to activate on the spot. So what he does is he calls them and he tries to scramble reinforcements to Benghazi. He tries to get to tell them to send armed men to protect the compound and to repel the attack. After this, he says he works through his defense attaché to try to get the Pentagon to scramble jets. His thinking was that if they managed to do a show of force, scramble Air Force jets over the compound, this may have made the militants scared. This may have made them think that there was an airstrike coming and it may have dispersed the crowd. However, he was told that there were no planes that could arrive in time, that it was going to take several hours at the very least to get planes off the ground because there was no way to refuel them on flight. After that, he says, there were four special operation troops who were in Tripoli as part of the embassy mission there, and he tried to get them on a plane the following morning to go to Benghazi to help with the evacuation. But AFRICOM, the U.S. military command in Africa, who had responsibility for this four-man team, said that that was a bad idea, and they shot it down.
Here's an exchange there between Hicks and Republican Jason Chaffetz of Utah.
How did the personnel react to being told to stand down?
They were furious. I will quote Lieutenant Colonel Gibson. He said, "This is the first time in my career that a diplomat has more balls than somebody in the military."
Gregory Hicks, the number two in Tripoli, as all of this happened. Now, to be clear, that was, you were saying they were trying to get them out there the following morning. I mean, the dead were dead by that time, right?
Right. There's no disagreement that if these men had been allowed to board this Libyan military aircraft, they wouldn't have arrived in time to stop either of the two attacks. However, the call to stand down came after the attack on the State Department compound, but before the subsequent attack on the CIA base. And this order was handed down when there was still a lot of confusion about what exactly was happening in Benghazi and whether or not the Americans who were left on the ground there were safe and needed help.
Had the deaths already occurred at the CIA base, which was a bit remote from the consulate at that time, or could they have still made it before those deaths occurred?
No, they couldn't have made it before the attack on the CIA, and there was no knowledge that there was an imminent second attack on that second facility.
I mean, could any lives have been saved, is my question, from what you heard yesterday, or were these people likely already dead as this was being debated?
You know, it seems very unlikely that these four special operation troopers could have gotten there in time to make a difference in terms of saving lives. However, one of them had medical skills that were deemed essential to trying to provide the wounded Americans with perhaps life-saving treatment. So that was the thinking of officials on the ground, including Hicks, that because you had wounded Americans who needed to be evacuated quickly and possibly needed specialized medical attention, that these four guys, would have been more valuable early that morning in Benghazi and accompanying the wounded Americans to Tripoli.
But as Jason Chaffetz told the Washington Post, your paper, I think it was published on Monday, that they could have provided first aid, not put up a perimeter around this in time to save lives. And then there was this exchange about how all this was characterized. And of course, famously, UN Ambassador Susan Rice, 5 days after those September 11th attacks, was on the Sunday shows, including here NBC's Meet the Press. She was linking the attacks to the controversial movie mocking Islam, saying this was related to protests over that we'd already seen in Cairo.
This is a spontaneous reaction to a video, and it's not dissimilar, but perhaps on a slightly larger scale than what we have seen in the past with the satanic verses with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad.
Here's Gregory Hicks yesterday, the number two then in Tripoli, responding, describing how he responded to that characterization of what happened in Benghazi.
I was stunned. My jaw dropped. And I was embarrassed.
Why was he stunned, Ernesto?
He was stunned because they had provided Washington with a very clear picture of what had happened. And in their account, you know, there was never a mention of a spontaneous protest. And they never saw indications that this movie had galvanized people around the U.S. missions in Benghazi that night and played any role in the attack. So they were flabbergasted as to why the U.S. government was providing this narrative days after it knew better. And for Republicans on the Hill who have long suspected that there's been a cover-up, that there has been a concerted effort by the White House and by the State Department to sort of sugarcoat the story, to cherry pick the facts that they want to put out in the public domain. This account from Hicks was essentially red meat for them. It was something that they felt validated their argument that the White House has been less than forthcoming, and that all these months later, we still don't have a crystal clear account of what happened that night.
Is it clear to you that he was demoted for making this kind of protest?
Well, the State Department pushed back on that notion. When he came back to Washington after the death of Chris Stevens, he says that he was challenged by his superiors and that he was later told it would be a bad idea to return. And at this time, there was it was an off-cycle for new jobs in the State Department, which is common. So essentially, he's now in a placeholder job, and presumably he'll get to bid for overseas assignments soon again.
At a desk, we'll see Ernesto Londoño with the Washington Post. Thank you very much, Ernesto.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Benghazi. Again, the attacks, the aftermath, the finger-pointing, the politics. A big hearing yesterday, a long tale on a tragic night. Lots of characterizations of what was going on yesterday. At the outset, House Oversight Committee Chairman Daryl Issa, Republican out of California, in his opening statement, accused the Obama administration, with the complicity of minority Democratic members of his committee, of stonewalling efforts to get to the bottom of what happened in Benghazi.
I want those watching this proceeding to know that we've made extensive efforts to engage the administration and to see and hear their facts. The administration, however, has not been cooperative, and unfortunately, our minority has mostly sat silent as we've made these requests.
Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland pushed back, saying, look, this has become essentially more like a witch hunt. Here's Cummings.
Let me be clear. I am not questioning the motives of our witnesses. I am questioning the motives of those who want to use their statements for political purposes.
And here's a Democrat, Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, saying he heard nothing incriminating in the day's testimony.
I don't think there's a smoking gun today. I don't even think there's a lukewarm slingshot.
Not even a lukewarm slingshot, but that was not the way Republicans characterized the insights of the day, not by any means. Let's wade on in here. With us right now from McLean, Virginia, is Peter Wehner, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's been writing a series of opinion pieces for Commentary Magazine on the Benghazi investigations. There's a link to them at our website, onpointradio.org. Served in the administrations of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and with the Office of Strategic Initiatives with President George W. Bush. Peter Wehner, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
And with us from Washington, Ambassador Christopher Hill. He's now dean of the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies. He was a career diplomat, served as U.S. ambassador to Iraq in the Obama administration and Secretary of State for East Asia Pacific Affairs, ambassador to Poland, Macedonia, South Korea in the Bush administration. Ambassador Christopher Hill, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Peter Wehner, first to you. What to you was most important out of yesterday's hearings in Washington?
Well, I think what was most important is you had three credible witnesses who revealed facts that I think massively undermine the administration's narrative, that the pillars of the story that the administration told after the attacks crumbled, and that had to do both with their insistence that what happened was a spontaneous demonstration, not a terrorist-inspired attack. We now know that the people closest on the ground at the time knew it was a terrorist attack. And indeed, Beth Jones, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, knew it as well. She sent an email linking the attacks to Ansar al-Sharia. We know that the role of the YouTube video, which the Obama administration had said triggered these attacks had no role at all. We know that there were, as you discussed earlier, efforts at intimidation for the people who actually came forward, the whistleblowers, which I think is problematic. So, look, I think that this thing advanced the story and the investigation. We don't know the full truth, but I think we know more of the truth than we did before the investigation and the hearing.
Didn't the Obama administration essentially, though, come away from, move away from the YouTube video explanation pretty quickly after this? I mean, they no longer are asserting that that's what caused this, right?
No, they didn't. Actually, weeks after the attack, the president, in a speech to the United Nations, made several references to the YouTube video. Of course, Susan Rice made repeated references to the YouTube video when she was on the Sunday shows 5 days after.
Yeah.
Jay Carney did as well. Now, the thing that's important to understand is that the people knew at the time and reported at the time what was going on, and that the YouTube videos had no role. Indeed, Steve Hayes in the Weekly Standard had a fairly important story in which he was able to compare early talking points for the Benghazi scandal to what was eventually what eventually emerged. There were no references to the YouTube video in the early accounts. There were references to Islamic terrorist attacks, which were taken out, and there were references to attacks, not to demonstrations. So, what's the big picture here? The big picture is that nobody on the ground asserted the YouTube videos had any role. The truth was known by the people on the ground. It was reported. But what was then reported to the American people by the president, by the Secretary of State, by the press secretary, by the UN ambassador, was that the YouTube videos caused this, and they did this for weeks after the attack. So I consider that to be problematic.
And what does all this suggest to you, or what's your conclusion from this about motivation, or the big picture of what you, as a pretty tough critic, think was essentially going on in the handling of this?
Well, one never knows motivations. The motivations of our own hearts are difficult enough to know what was going on.
But they matter, don't they? If it's just bumbling, that's one thing.
I think you're exactly right. Look, I think the weight of the evidence indicates there was a cover-up, not a criminal cover-up. We don't have any evidence of that. But I think that what had happened here, if I had to speculate, is several things. One is that we were essentially 2 months away from an election, that this story, if it had come out and it had accurately reported what happened, it would have hurt the president and his claim that al-Qaeda and Islamic terrorism was on the run. Secondly, I think that what was happening is that there were various people, including in the State Department, that were very concerned about covering their behinds, and they took efforts to try and do it. So I think there was a political motivation with an upcoming presidential election, and I also think there was probably an ideological aspect to this, which is that the Obama administration has, I think, made it very clear that they're very, very skeptical about talking about Islamic terrorism. We saw that with the Fort Hood shooting, where it was clearly driven by a radicalized Islamic person, Major Nadel Hassan, but it was referred to in the official report as workplace violence. They don't like to talk about Islamic terrorism. This was clearly what was going on. So I think that some of their own sort of ideological dispositions shaped how they told the story as well.
Peter Wehner, stand by. Ambassador Hill, come in. We'll pull back to the big picture for a second, but first take us to yesterday's hearing. What you heard, what you saw unfolding there. I mean, here was the number two to Ambassador Chris Stevens, who I imagine you knew, with some clearly very emotional reporting on what happened there and strong feelings about what happened both on that night and early the next morning and to himself in the aftermath. What did you make of what we heard yesterday, Ambassador?
Well, first of all, I share the view of those who found it kind of riveting testimony. I mean, it was extraordinary to have the person who spoke to Chris Stevens last be out there testifying, explaining that phone call, explaining his own frustration. I mean, after all, he's in Tripoli, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he knows everything going on in Benghazi, that he has, you know, better communications to Benghazi than, for example, the National Military Command Center or the State Department Operations Center. So you could see his kind of level of frustration. He came up with this idea that perhaps U.S. fighter jets could buzz the crowd at early, you know, 2
yeah,
in the morning.
That's what
or
he
so.
Was asking for. Get some jets over there. Have them fly low. To what end?
Yeah. And I understand the idea, but, you know, to scramble jets, to get them refueled, to get them to cross the Mediterranean, to get them to know precisely where to go, to inform local authorities so no one fires a surface-to-air missile at them. I mean, these are kind of tough things to get organized, and I could see his level of frustration that his idea wasn't acted upon. But I guess I have problems with the concept that somehow the military didn't respond as best they could. I think the military looked at some options, and the options were frankly not there. And as for the idea of sending some special forces members on a Libyan C-130, essentially after the fact, I could see why people said, "Now wait a minute, we don't have enough fidelity on this. Sending 4 people into this may not be the smartest move." So they decided not to do it.
And 4 was and all they had of those of those forces in Tripoli, as if I understood correctly from yesterday's testimony. Yeah. That would have been sending the entire squad out.
That's right. And it's not surprising to me, though, that the embassy started getting information that perhaps the embassy itself would be attacked. I mean, if I were in that position and I was in a similar position in Macedonia, you start burning your files very quickly. I mean, you get down to like a 30-minute burn time because there is a real expectation that you could be overrun. So, you know, Mr. Hicks had a lot to do that night. He had a lot of coordinating to do. But I'm not sure he was the best person to understand the overall picture. I suspect that there's better fidelity in places like the National Military Command Center, and that's where some of those decisions were made not to scramble jets, et cetera.
Well, let's go to the characterization then, because we heard that some of those people further removed in intelligence perhaps had helped inform Susan Rice in order to give her talking points for those comments where she characterized this as coming out of the anti-Muslim video that was circulating on YouTube
right.
and protests around that. I mean, he was clearly very dismayed at that characterization and seems to have felt, I don't know, blindsided or betrayed or something by it.
Right. I think one thing to keep in mind is the context of all this. And you recall that that same night there were our embassy in Cairo was literally besieged and almost overrun by protesters over that video. If you look at what happened in Tunis, same type of very violent reaction. So whether it was extrapolation or interpolation, I think there was some view that this must be what's happening in Tripoli. Now, the question I think everyone has is, you know, within 5 days, it was pretty clear that there were some other elements of this, namely an armed attack by a militia group. And so why did Susan Rice go ahead with talking points that frankly look a little stale?
Well, this is very important to Peter Wehner's point that it could smell of political motivation. We don't want that characterization out in advance of the presidential election.
I mean, well, the first question is, why is the UN ambassador speaking about an embassy? After all, she had no role in supervising it, no role in the chain of command there. She was up in New York minding her own store. So
some have said that's political, too. Hillary Clinton, you know, it was not out there talking about it. Susan Rice was.
Right. Well, there's a question that can be posed to the both of them, and I think it has been on many occasions. But I think any spokesperson in any government organization, you're given these talking points, and you look to the person who's giving you those talking points, and you say, "Are you sure this is right? Is this really what happened?" And then you really try to drill down and make sure that when you get up there using someone else's words, that those words are accurate. I mean, this happens all the time. I remember Mike McCrory in the State Department; he never would take press guidance from some bureau unless he really drilled down to make sure it was accurate.
But how could it be so far off? That you have Gregory Hicks yesterday, number 2 in Libya, saying that when he heard this characterization, Susan Rice's comments, he said he was stunned, his jaw dropped, he was embarrassed. How could you have that kind of chasm?
Well, again, I can't speak to Mr. Hicks's state of mind, or I can imagine he had gone through a lot there. But I think what was happening was these talking points were reflective of an overall situation in the Middle East. And bear in mind, you know, from the point of view of Washington that night or before the incident with Chris Stevens, there was a great deal of concern about, you know, what was to become of our embassy in Cairo. I mean, this is the big place in the Middle East. And finally, I think it's important that one of the great tragedies of this, I mean, is that in addition to the tragedy of Chris Stevens dying, of course, we still don't know his story. Why did he choose to go to Benghazi, which was obviously a place where there was no consensus in Washington that it would be a future constituent post? Mr. Hicks suggests that Secretary Clinton wanted it to be a constituent post.
And what does constituent post mean?
Meaning that it would be an official U.S. government establishment.
Rather than just a CIA outpost or something.
Rather than an outpost. Now, what has happened, of course, in these past difficult 10 or 12 years is the State Department has tried to kind of be out there and not, you know, wait for the military to give the all clear sign. I mean, the State Department has managed risk and opened up posts that maybe in years past it wouldn't have opened up. So it had gone ahead and done this in a kind of dicey circumstance. And again, we don't have all the details from the CIA, but it was clear the CIA was interested in Benghazi, and not just from the point of view of kind of keeping faith with the originators of the Libyan revolution.
Are you suggesting it was a misstep for the ambassador Stevens to even be there that night?
Again, we don't know the motivation for the ambassador to go on a several-day visit with several overnights in a dicey place. But I can tell you that in the last 12 years, we've all had to manage risk in this sense. We've all had to manage the concerns that there are security problems here versus the needs to be there, to be talking to people, to be trying to help in the process of calming the situation. And so he had to make a judgment there. But we don't know a lot about that judgment, how it was done. But what we do know is it was his choice. No one in the State Department was saying, Chris, you got to go to Benghazi this week. This was his choice. So I think questions like that would have been interesting if Mr. Hicks had had some thoughts on that issue, because surely they sat in the embassy and they talked about this multi-day and multi-night trip. And surely the issue of security would have come up in the context of those discussions.
Peter Weiner, you talked about the big picture. I mean, who's being holistic here, looking at the whole picture, and who's cherry picking? You know, you can kind of make the case either way.
Yeah, look, I don't know. We don't know until this investigation fully unfolds and we know the full truth. The way that these things work traditionally in terms of members of Congress is if you're a member of the party or the president who's under attack, you accuse the other side of being political, and if you're of the other party, you say you're interested in finding the truth. My own sense is that in watching the hearings yesterday, that the Republicans were really pushing to try and elicit information from the witnesses, and the Democrats were less interested. I just wanted to come back to several things Ambassador Hill said.
We've got half a minute before the break, Peter. Pick one, and we'll come back.
Okay. He mentioned that the talking points were a little bit stale. I think that probably understates the case. It wasn't that they were
Susan
stale.
Rice's, you know, 5 days.
Susan Rice, what she said, it was that they were flat out wrong. She made several assertions that were simply and demonstrably false. The other thing that I just want to say is that from what we know of the talking points, the references to the YouTube videos were not made in the talking points. That came up somewhere else. And the third point I just want to make is that we actually had an accurate interpretation of events at the beginning of the process, and the early talking points showed it. And we now know the key figures in the State Department, including Beth Jones, knew that it was an Islamic attack. There is a contemporaneous email.
Peter Weiner, stand by right there if you'd be good enough. We have to take a short break right here. Peter Weiner, Ambassador Christopher Hill. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Benghazi, again, the attacks, the aftermath, the finger pointing, the politics. A big hearing yesterday, a long tale on a tragic night in Libya. Peter Wehner is with us, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's been writing a lot in Commentary magazine about the whole attack and its long aftermath. You can link to his stories, some of them at our website, onpointradio.org. Ambassador Christopher Hill is with us, former U.S. ambassador to Poland, Macedonia, South Korea, Iraq in Baghdad, now dean of the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, joins us today from Washington. Peter, I know you got a couple more points there. Let me get a couple of callers in and we'll come to them. Susan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that the whole point of this exercise, the congressional hearings, is that for the first time, the American people can truly hear what was going on from people who were there, and that cannot be underestimated. Thank you to C-SPAN for carrying it without the interruptions that you get or the slanted views of some of the stations that have been carrying the hearings. One of the points that I think is sometimes overlooked, while there's a lot of partisanship about why these hearings are being held, I think the American people just need to hear and be able to make up their mind for themselves. But the length of time, the 8 months it has taken to get to this point, is just amazing.
Susan, what does it all go to for you? What's the bottom line about why this matters for you?
Why it matters is I've always thought that the American people stood for truth and justice. We need justice for the people who died. We need to make sure that these types of things are handled appropriately. My husband has been involved with the U.S. Marine Corps. One of the witnesses in the congressional hearings is a former U.S. Marine and was part of the security. Of course, Mr. Hicks, all of three witnesses, they understand their careers are probably over despite what Elijah Cummings said about protecting whistleblowers. And so I applaud their courage.
Susan, I appreciate your call. I think we've got the perspective and more, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here, if I may, from Bluffton, South Carolina. Rich, you're on the air.
First, I'd like to say, Tom, that the loss of any lives, it's a national and a personal tragedy for everybody involved. But for me, like most everything that's happening in Congress, this stinks of politics. It's about the hypocrisy of scale. And I'm an independent. I don't have any political axe to grind here.
What do you mean the politics of hypocrisy of scale? What do you mean?
If you go back, we're talking about an Islamic terrorist attack in Benghazi that cost four American lives and what was done to prevent that. If you go back to pre-9/11, Richard Clark, it's my understanding, tried the first time that the Bush administration met with him was the day after 9/11. For months and months and months and months and months before 9/11, he went to the State Department and contacted them, Condoleezza Rice, et cetera. We are going to get hit in the homeland.
And there you had thousands and war that followed and all the rest. I guess I see what you mean. That's an interesting point. Peter, let me bring that to you. We hear Susan. She's very happy to hear all this rolled out there. She wants truth and justice. What about this Rich's complaint here that there's a kind of hypocrisy of scale? You know, 9/11 was one thing. Here we've got, it's tragic, but on a small, lesser scale, and yet all this attention. What do you say to that, Peter?
Well, I'd say several things. Look, this is not on the scale of 9/11, and nobody is saying that it is. And what happened in 9/11 needs to be treated on its own merits. On the other hand, this is 2013. This happened contemporaneously. It happened 8 months ago, and it matters what the truth is. And to those who say that, you know, that this stinks of politics, look, all I can tell you is you can't take the politics out of politics. You had politics in the Watergate hearings. You had it in the Iran-Contra hearings. You had it during the Lewinsky scandal. That's the nature of the beast. But what people have to try and do is sort through political motivations, demagoguery, and all of the rest, and as best they can, ascertain what the truth and the reality is, because it really does matter if, in fact, the president and his team went forward and gave a false account of events, and especially if they knew it was false. We don't know that for sure, but the evidence that we have to date is troubling. As I said, we now know that there were key people within the State Department that knew within 24 hours that this was a terrorist attack. And yet what we were told 5 days after and weeks after is that this was spontaneous, there was no terrorist element. And then there's this YouTube video, which they pinned it on. The president spoke about it at the United Nations. There was no evidence of it. It was never asserted by the people on the ground. And it wasn't even in the talking point.
But as Ambassador Hill says, I mean, we did have these fierce attacks going on in Cairo, also in Tunis. I mean, it's not like Libya wasn't bracketed by big crowds, violent in the streets, just in that very same set of, what, a day or hours?
Right. I agree. But I would just simply say several things. Number one, that Egypt and Libya are different, and it was Ambassador Rice's obligation to speak about Libya. Secondly, we knew what was going on at the time. We know it. There was no assertion of it. It is just incredible to me that you would go and make the leap, and not only have Susan Rice make the leap, but the president, weeks after, continue to push this YouTube video when you had people on the ground who said, and we heard yesterday, that it played no role at all. We just know, it's now, I think, demonstrable fact, that there were key people in the administration that knew that the line that we were told days and weeks later were fundamentally false. And we need to find out why and who was responsible for that. But I think that that's problematic.
Different attitudes on that, of course. Here was Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State then, still, at a Senate hearing on Benghazi. This was in January. Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin asking her about whether the Benghazi terror attack had been the result of a protest. And Secretary of State Clinton gave her now famous or infamous, depending where you how you look at it, response.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
Justin in Montreal, Canada is calling. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Okay. What do you think?
Good. Listen, I just want to talk about like what you were saying before, is if it's a cover up, what's going on in Libya and the whole story that's happened afterwards. And one thing that I'm not hearing them talk about, I heard your guest talk about truth and finding the truth.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot of politics and a lot of lies going around. Not shady comments. They're all lying right now. But what's going on in Africa is this huge spreading of weapons from Libya. All the arms depots are in Libya. All those weapons are going all around Africa, and we're finding, you know, guys in Somalia with special assault rifles from Libya. So no one's really talking about this huge proliferation of all the weapons that were stored by Gaddafi before, you know, the U.S. went in and took them out. But
yeah, we have heard about that, Justin. We've talked about it on this show, Mali and beyond. A lot of things were unleashed there. Of course, there was pressure to go into Libya to help the Libyan people out when Gaddafi was there. I mean, I take your point, but I think that's a subject for another hour. Let me get another one here, John in Savannah, Georgia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a comment or ask a question. If the fact that funding for our diplomatic service has been being cut by the Congress for years, and I just was wondering if that might in fact have some impact on what happened there, the fact that, you know,
security funding, all kinds of funding. John will pick it up. Ambassador Hill, how about that? That goes around, that this Congress has cut back on funds for the State Department for our foreign presence, perhaps including security, and that might have played some role here. What about it, Ambassador?
Well, first of all, I don't think it played a big role in this issue in Benghazi. I think the problem in Benghazi was there was a need felt by some other agencies, including the CIA, to have this place open. There was no decision about whether to put adequate security there, or I should say to keep adequate security there, because they did have some security there for a while. As this kind of bureaucratic impasse continued, where they really couldn't make the decision to put people there, there. The overall situation seemed to be getting better, and as often happens in bureaucracy, time cures the problem. So I think Benghazi was not so much a problem of a lack of security; it was a lack of decision to staff it up and to maintain it as a long-term post. Clearly, Chris Stevens wanted to see it become a consulate. I suspect some of the security people felt that it would require too many upgrades to do something like that, and so they kind of kept it going as it was. But again, these are tough times, and the State Department has to be out in places before we have the full accoutrement of what the military would call force protection.
But this is a big argument.
You know? Yeah.
It's a big argument that gets made that people say, well, Republicans cut funding for security, and then how will when things go wrong? And you're saying no.
Well, I would just be careful of those arguments. I certainly have been on the losing end of efforts to get more funding for various things. But I don't think it's very helpful to talk about it in partisan terms. I think the issue really is, how do we manage risk in a fast-changing world? Do we wait for all the security upgrades to be there before we put a person in there? And I don't think that's an answer. I think we have to be out there and managing the risk. And some would argue that Benghazi was too much risk. Too much risk to have our ambassador there, too much risk to have people there in general. So I think those are the questions. And I think the State Department in recent years, for all the people who say the State Department hasn't been out there, hasn't been involved in what the military called the surge, I think the State Department has done a lot. And I think what we see in Benghazi was an example of really trying to press the envelope, really trying to deal with a tough situation, and unfortunately seeing that the security problems overwhelmed the decision.
Is the risk that was taken here in Benghazi and the narrative of what happened in the aftermath, is it, in your view, as a career diplomat, high level, is it a wrap on then Secretary of State Clinton?
The Secretary of State has hundreds of posts to deal with. So while you can pin blame, I do believe that this is something that is at a lower level, where the bureaucracy that is the Near East Bureau, the diplomatic security, the various offices that deal with these things need to come to a consensus. And I think what they are trying to do is to keep this place open, keep it going, so that we could have our operations there. Clearly, the CIA was very interested in this going, and they made a calculation. But I really don't think, from a practical basis, that this is something that the Secretary of State was tracking every day.
Kevin in Taunton, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'll be quick. In my opinion, this is politics, and it's the worst kind of politics because it's a witch hunt. Republicans don't want Hillary Clinton to run for president if they can smear Obama with their, quote, Watergate-type scandal. Then they kill two birds with one stone. They destroy his legacy, they stop Clinton, and then they don't have to do any more of their reach out. It's sad. I mean, I remember that day. I was listening to NPR, and Cairo was basically under attack, and Benghazi, and Tripoli. I mean, for them to just try to make the fog of war into some kind of scandal is a scandal itself. That's just my comment.
Kevin, we've got it. I'll take it to both my guests. Ambassador, first to you. Here's Kevin, who says, this is an attempt to kill two birds with one stone, smear Obama, smear Clinton. But what do you think? When Hillary Clinton said, what difference at this point does it make, in that emotional testimony in January, do you think she's right? Or do we still need to look back at this? Is it worthy?
I don't think her comment was in the context of we need to forget about this. Quite the contrary. She was saying we need to look at all our procedures and make sure that we avoid this again. Her point was these people have died, and whether it was a premeditated attack or not, we have to look at overall security, whether what the decisions were, what we need to do to button up better, how we manage risk in the future. So I think that's what she was addressing. I think, though, that I understand the point about politics, but I also understand that we live in a country where people really like to see all the facts in front of them, and so I'm not surprised that a continuation, that there were these hearings. After all, we had not heard from people on the ground before, so I saw no problem in doing that. And yes, indeed, as Peter suggested, there's sometimes politics in hearings, but I think that's the system we've chosen, and I think we ought to live with that and just try to make sure we can learn as much as we can about this and avoid this kind of thing in the future.
Peter, we've got our caller Susan applauding these hearings, but then you hear our caller just now, you know, complaining that Republicans are turning Benghazi into some kind of, I don't know, easy one-stop shopping to attack a sitting president and a potential future president. What about that that critique, Peter?
Look, I think that the hearings are worthwhile. I think that there's some grandstanding and demagoguery that goes on, but you actually get facts that come out that bear on the truth of the story. So I think, in general, this is a good thing. And I think that the caller is indicative of a kind of ideological mindset that a lot of people have, which is that they just choose up teams. You're either on the Republican team or the Democratic team, and any time anybody goes after somebody on your team, you cry witch hunt, and you assail their motivations. That happens. It happens on both sides. You have to try and cut through it. What you have to do, if you're a responsible citizen and a responsible individual, is to try and see where the facts go, where the objective facts lead. And I think that the hearing yesterday moved us forward in that area. There's still a lot more that needs to be known, but we're further along than we were, and that's a good thing. And I would hope that Kevin would be glad, because sunlight is the best disinfectant, as it's been said.
Well, some eager to keep the spotlight right on it, some less so. We certainly heard that from both angles yesterday. Grateful to Ernesto Londoño with The Washington Post for kicking us off today, and to you, Peter Wehner, with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Link to Peter Wehner's reporting on this at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter, thank you very much for being with us today.
I enjoyed being with you. Thanks.
And Ambassador Christopher Hill, Dean of the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, former U.S. Ambassador to Poland, South Korea, Iraq, and Baghdad, knows a bit himself. Ambassador Hill, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much for your insights.
Pleasure.
Tomorrow, Friday, Week in Review, we'll look at all the trouble in Cleveland, Dow at 15,000, all the sexual assault problems in the U.S. military, Mark Sanford, all the rest. Join us then. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.